Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, normally recorded in our studio at the Bishopbriggs Media Centre, currently recorded from our volunteers' homes. To keep in touch with us, use our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, which are all at Q and Review. That's CUEANDREVIEW. Or get in touch via information@qandreview.com. That's information@CUEANDREVIEW.com. Please like and share our podcasts and give us any constructive feedback.
You're listening to The National as published on Friday the 5th of November 2021. News. Royal Bank of Scotland. Firms forced to boost salaries to keep employees, report says, by Gregor Young. Businesses will be forced to increase pay to keep and hire staff after recent months saw a loss of momentum in the Scottish labour market and a slump in confidence, two reports have found. A Royal Bank of Scotland survey of recruiters found hiring activity growth slowed in October despite a strong demand for staff. The survey found there was a steep decline in the supply of both permanent and short-term workers and sharp rates of vacancy growth. Panellists surveyed attributed the difficulties finding candidates to strong demand, the coronavirus pandemic and Brexit. Availability of permanent staff also dropped at a near-record pace. This was despite salaries for permanent starters rising for the 11th time in as many months. Sebastian Burnside, Chief Economist at Royal Bank of Scotland, said, "Following a survey record uplift in hiring activity during the third quarter, the latest data point to a slight loss of momentum in the Scottish labour market. With the labour market running hot, supply and demand imbalances may limit firms' abilities to fill roles in the months ahead, while also pushing firms to up their pay offers in order to secure or even retain staff." A separate report by the Federation of Small Businesses, FSB, found rising overheads are leading to a slump in Scottish business confidence. Around three quarters, 77%, of Scottish businesses surveyed in late September by the group said the cost of running their business has increased since this time last year. FSB's Scottish Small Business Confidence Index fell to 1.2 points in the third quarter of 2021 from 20.5 points in the second quarter. It said the typical Scottish business is now less optimistic than the UK average, a reversal to the situation seen over the summer. Andrew McRae, FSB Scotland Policy Chair, said, "Scottish business optimism bounced back over the summer but has slumped in the autumn. That's partly because the easing of COVID restrictions delivered a big confidence boost that's waned over time. However, punishing rises in business overheads are also taking their toll on the trading outlook. And with a rise in payroll taxes on the way, there's no end in sight." David Equi, Managing Director of Equi's Ice Cream in Hamilton, said a rise in energy prices had hit plans to grow his business. He said, "These spiralling energy prices make realising these ambitions so much harder. After surviving the COVID crisis, I'm frustrated that government isn't prepared to step up to protect local and independent firms." The RBS data was collected from about 100 Scottish recruitment and employment consultancies between October the 12th and 25th. FSB surveyed 1,370 small businesses between September the 21st and October the 1st, with 168 from Scotland. This article was by Gregor Young. You're listening to The National as published on Friday the 5th of November 2021. News. Scottish Tories' anger at Boris Johnson's madness in Owen Paterson scandal, by Xander Richards, multimedia journalist. The Scottish Tories are furious at Boris Johnson's botched handling of the Owen Paterson scandal, reports say. According to the Times newspaper, senior figures in Douglas Ross's party believe the government's humiliating U-turn, which came despite having won a vote in the Commons, has undermined their position at Holyrood. One source told that paper, "With friends like these, who needs enemies?" The UK government's plan to overhaul the standards process and block the suspension of Paterson, who was found guilty of lobbying on behalf of companies paying him £100,000 per year, was supported by four Scottish Tories at Westminster. However, Scottish Secretary Alistair Jack did not vote due to COP26 commitments, and Ross avoided the vote altogether, claiming he couldn't support the change as Paterson was being investigated. Scottish Tories at Holyrood were reportedly baffled by their bosses in London's plans to support Paterson, saying it would make it more difficult for them to question the SNP over impropriety. According to The Times, one MSP described Boris Johnson's decision as madness, with another saying it made any kind of sensible comment on standards impossible. The Tories have repeatedly called for Nicola Sturgeon to step down amid claims she broke the ministerial code, but have remained publicly silent about the sleaze engulfing their own party south of the border. Scottish Secretary Jack agreed the time of the Paterson debate had not been ideal, but later refused to join his other Conservative colleagues in criticising Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards Catherine Stone. Labour have called for Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng to face an investigation after he called on Stone to consider her position in the wake of the Paterson affair. Despite it being the Tories mired in sleaze, Kwarteng said it was difficult to see what the future of the Commissioner is, given the fact that we're reviewing the process and we're overturning and trying to reform this whole process. This article was by Xander Richards.
This article is from the Glasgow Times, date 5th November 2021, from the opinion section. COP26 is going well, but that's not enough. By Malcolm Cunning. Everyone from Joe Biden to Greta Thunberg to Leo DiCaprio is in town, along with tens of thousands of delegates and activists. It has been a week that Glaswegians won't forget in a hurry. Yes, there has been inevitable disruption for citizens with road closures, protests, and the refuse workers' strike. But what is at stake is so important for the future of every community on Earth. There is still some time to go before COP26 leaves the city and the hard work gets underway behind closed doors now. The announcements so far are welcome. The US and the EU have announced a global partnership to cut emissions of the greenhouse gas methane by 2030. The Indian Prime Minister said he will switch half the country's power grid to renewable sources. And more than 100 international leaders have signed a declaration to halt and reverse deforestation and land degradation by 2030. US climate convoy John Kerry has said he's never seen such urgency, commitment or energy in climate talks. That's the good news, but it's not enough. Over these remaining days, we need to move beyond prepackaged announcements. What really matters is whether we cut carbon emissions by half this decade, and we're still a long way behind. We need to secure a firm plan to keep 1.5 degrees alive and deliver for people at home and around the world this decisive decade. It is incredibly encouraging that Glasgow is shaping up to be a turning point in the global debate about climate emergency. It's not just that COP26 is on home soil that we're hearing so much about it. Nearly the entire world is taking it seriously. The hope remains that our city will not only be remembered as the moment when leaders woke up to the crisis, but the moment a planet-saving deal was agreed. That is what is at stake here. But regardless of what is achieved in the international negotiations, we must start to lead by example at home. While Nicola Sturgeon lectures the world on the global environment, her government has missed its renewable heating target and its gas emissions target for 3 years running. And the First Minister promised 130,000 green jobs by 2020. But we have just a fraction of that at around 21,000. I imagine Nicola Sturgeon omitted this inconvenient truth when she met Greta this week. The Scottish Government needs to use its sweeping powers to start delivering credible action here in the UK. And the same goes for Boris Johnson. The Prime Minister has had a wake-up call about the dire situation we are in. Yet, unsurprisingly, he utterly failed to rise to the occasion during his trip to Glasgow. When he's not dreaming up new metaphors for his incoherent speeches, he's flirting with a new coal mine, stripping out temperature commitments from trade deals, opening up massive new oil exploration and cutting overseas aid. For the sake of Glasgow, Scotland and the UK and the world, we need less hot air from our governments and more decisive action to reduce emissions. That article was by Malcolm Cunning. This article is from the Glasgow Times, date 5th November 2021, from the Lifestyle section. Glasgow MasterChef Gary McLean awarded prestigious St Andrews Society honour. By Deborah Anderson. Scotland's MasterChef Gary McLean has been given the prestigious honour of the Mark Twain Award by our American cousins. The St Andrews Society of the State of New York announced that Mr McLean will be given this year's prize and will be presented with the award at a gala event later this month. The award will be given out at the 265th anniversary banquet and recognises individuals who help envision the future, identify paths to success and carry out a vision. Recipients are described as leaders in their respective fields and are recognised by their peers for their contributions. Mr McLean, who won MasterChef The Professionals Champion 2016, was described by the Society as a distinguished Scot dedicated to his career in education and the advancement of healthy and sustainable food usage in the home. His first solo restaurant, Creel Cot, located in Edinburgh's Bonnie and Wild Market, is committed to sustainable sourcing with the finest Scottish seafood. He is also chief lecturer at the City of Glasgow College, where he's been teaching for the last 20 years. Mr McLean said, "I am honoured and humbled to be the recipient of this year's Mark Twain Award from the St Andrews Society of the New York State. The Society's humanitarian work over the last 265 years to help the people that need it most in the US and Scotland is truly inspiring. To be honoured in such a way from them is incredible." David M. Murphy, Society President, said, "We are privileged to honour Gary McLean with the 2021 Mark Twain Award. He is a talented author, educator and entrepreneur who exemplifies the future of Scotland. His love for his country and passion for helping others can be seen in every aspect of his life and career." Dr. Paul Little, Principal and CEO, said, "On behalf of the City of Glasgow College, we congratulate Chef McLean on receiving this prestigious award. Over the years, Gary has been an inspiration to so many young people, demonstrating his love and passion for the culinary industry. A true advocate for his vocation, Gary has also worked tirelessly in forging partnerships between his beloved Scotland and the United States of America. It's a wonderful endorsement that his hard work and dedication have been recognised as the recipient of the Mark Twain Award." That article was by Deborah Anderson. This article is from The National, date 5th November 2021, from the Culture section. Scottish Fiddle Orchestra to make long-awaited return to stage, by Gregor Young. The Scottish Fiddle Orchestra is to make a return to the stage with a celebratory Edinburgh concert. The group will make a long-awaited return with their annual Hogmanay celebration at Usher Hall in Edinburgh on December 30th, with thousands of guests expected to flock to the special gig. The event will be the orchestra's first indoor concert since February 2020, and will provide an evening of entertainment that will get toes tapping and herald the new year. The Scottish Fiddle Orchestra will perform at Scotland's only five-star concert hall with conductor Blair Parm at the helm. There will be pipers welcoming guests on arrival, stunning vocals from mezzo-soprano Colette Rudy, and an 80-strong flock of fiddlers and other musicians to raise the roof of the Usher Hall. People of all ages can enjoy lively toe-tapping jigs and reels, poignant slow airs and a sprinkling of well-known songs at the seated gig. The orchestra, who have been tradition bearers for the Scottish music for more than 40 years, held their last Hogmanay celebration in 2019 with a 1,800-strong audience. This summer, they held a number of outdoor concerts, which were hailed as a great success. Bob Diamond, chairman of the Scottish Fiddle Orchestra, said, "We are delighted to be able to make an emotional return to the stage for our first indoor performance since before the pandemic began. Everyone involved can't wait to put on a special show, and it will certainly be a great way to celebrate ahead of the new year after a two-year hiatus." The Hogmanay celebration is a concert that can be really enjoyed by all, couples and families looking to do something special during the festive season, friends wanting to enjoy moving performances together, and visitors interested in soaking up Scottish culture. It will be an incredible night with some dazzling displays. The joyful and enthusiastic audience reaction we received at our outdoor concerts in the summer showed us just how much live music has been missed. Folk have a profound desire for the unique shared experience of major concerts. That article was by Gregor Young. This article is from The National, date 8th November 2021, from the Culture section. Annie Lennox reveals the inspiration behind her passion for activism, by Jane Cassidy. Annie Lennox has revealed that her grandparents and Eurythmics partner Dave Stewart's stepfather inspired her to become a social activist fighting for climate action. The Scottish music star and Glasgow Caledonian University Chancellor spoke with pride about how her working class grandparents fought for social justice. Lennox explained, "My passion for social activism came from my father's side of the family, who were working class shipyard workers and socialists. One half of my family was very socially conscious and active between the First and Second World Wars. My grandparents were social activists working outside factory gates, handing out pamphlets, fighting against the fascists that came up to Scotland trying to persuade working class people to join the fascist movement. I only found out about my grandparents' activism later on in life. Some of that consciousness has come from hearing those issues being discussed around the dinner table. It wasn't beaten into me, but somehow or another, there is something in the Lennox DNA that is very aware of injustice. It has always been the case. I feel it in my bones. It is in my blood and I cannot walk away from it. When I went down to London in 1971, something significant happened to me. The stepfather of Dave Stewart, my Eurythmics partner, was passionate about the glaciers melting. He had every book on the subject. Every Sunday, he used to go with a placard down to Camden Lock and tell people that the ice caps were melting and we were going to be flooded. It sounded quite eccentric at the time, but he knew that huge climate justice organisations were picking up on this. That is why I'm so passionate as Chancellor of Glasgow Caledonian University to encourage and inspire our students to actively take part in tackling this climate emergency. This is a real, serious, global pending catastrophe. I'm not going to mince my words because we can't hide it under the table anymore. We must speak candidly about it. Our young generation must inherit the earth, and it must be a fit place for our children and grandchild. Otherwise, we have no future. As GCU Chancellor, my role involves young students who work hard to become graduates, scientists, visionaries, planners, and leaders. I'm deeply concerned about the challenges they will have to face in the years that lie ahead." Aberdeen-born Lennox, now living in America, said she has become vegetarian to help reduce her impact on the planet, but wishes she could do more. She added, "I'm living here in America. Everything is plastic. To be quite frank, it haunts me because I don't personally know how to change a system that is all around me. If there was one thing, my one change is becoming vegetarian and not eating red meat. I live with despair. I'm dreadfully anxious about our future. Every day I feel, oh my God, we're stuck." Lennox hopes that when everyone leaves Glasgow after COP26, that world leaders will walk the talk. She said, "Being around COP26, everyone is focused on climate change. But afterwards, when everyone leaves, one has to walk one's talk. If large countries such as India and China do not get on board and really genuinely try to reduce their emissions, we are in real jeopardy. I am very proud it's taking place in Scotland, but I really have this terrible sense of dread. The latest UN report says we are missing the opportunity to build back better after the pandemic, and if we don't, we face disastrous temperature rises of at least 2.7 degrees if countries fail to meet their climate goals." That is really sobering. COP26 is not just about the talk, it's about meeting the pledges. So the outcome remains to be seen. That article was by Jane Cassidy. This article is from The National, date 8th November 2021, from the news section. Scotland's courts continue virtual hearings into 2022. By Martin Hannan. Restrictions and regulations imposed on Scotland's courts as a result of the coronavirus pandemic are to continue into next year, it was announced at the weekend. The Scottish Courts and Tribunal Service, or SCTS, stated that after Health Secretary Humza Yousaf's statement on increased efforts to combat the virus made to the Scottish Parliament last Tuesday, it has decided to maintain all existing safety measures for the next 3 months until the end of January 2022. SCTS said, "While the presumption remains that the majority of civil procedural business will continue to be heard virtually, the guidance enables substantive inner house and criminal appeal court business to be heard in person by default. All other civil business in the Court of Session and Sheriff Court will continue to be conducted virtually unless the court allows an in-person hearing on cause shown." The legal requirement for face coverings to be worn in SCTS buildings will continue, and the guidance for face coverings in the courtroom will remain in place. For criminal cases in the High Court, when it comes to hearings for sentencing, accused persons remanded in custody may appear by video link. Those accused persons released on bail must attend court in person unless their attendance has been excused. In Sheriff Court civil cases, the guidance states that all procedural civil hearings will, unless otherwise directed by the court, continue to be conducted remotely. SCTS added, "All other civil hearings will also be conducted remotely. Only where cause is shown in circumstances where physical distancing can be adhered to will the physical presence of witnesses be permitted. Fatal accident inquiries will also be conducted remotely unless the court directs otherwise." The updated guidance will apply from November 15th, SCTS stated. Eric McQueen, Chief Executive of SCTS, said, "Although case levels have reduced from their peak in early September, they remain at a high level. The virus has not gone away, and we need to continue to do all we can to keep ourselves, our colleagues, and all who use our buildings safe. Throughout the pandemic, we've taken a safety-first approach to our business. We continue to have some of the most robust measures in place across our buildings to maintain both safety and the throughput of business. The revisions to the operations of the Supreme, Sheriff and Justice of the Peace Courts are able to be made due to those measures being in place and as a result of ongoing collaboration with colleagues across the justice sector. As we look to a post-pandemic world, this collaboration will continue to be vital so we can build on the innovative approaches used during the pandemic. By doing so, we can further improve the system balancing safety, accessibility, and the best use of processes to protect people's rights and enhance access to justice. That article was by Martin Hannan.
From the National, Monday the 8th of November 2021, from the comment section, Scotland should borrow now to lay our independent economy's foundations. By Jim Osborne, Scottish Banking and Finance Group. During our series of articles so far, the Scottish Banking and Finance Group has been outlining key issues for Scottish independence and the preconditions necessary to make it a success by building a thriving economy, our own currency immediately upon gaining independence, a written democratic constitution which enshrines the fundamental rights of all citizens as well as our obligations to one another and to the state, and reform of our banking and financial system. This time we turn our attention to what can be done between now to lay the foundations for our independence. One of them is put the plans in place for the establishment of a central bank, the Scottish Reserve Bank, which is ready to go on day one. We have been consistent in arguing what needs to be done to build a productive economy, which is as self-sufficient as possible in providing for the needs of all Scottish citizens, particularly in strategic production, such as food and energy, and the goods and services needed to fulfil the fundamental rights set out in the Constitution. However, it would be a grave mistake to think we can wait until after independence to start work on this. The Scottish Government needs to start right now, despite the constraints imposed by devolution within the UK. In our article in The National on August the 23rd, Why We Must Talk About What We Want From Indy, we made some initial proposals, including the convening of a forum for heads of governance of the local government pension scheme, LGPS, and other large Scottish pension funds, the Scottish National Investment Bank, South Scottish Enterprise and local authority leaders to discuss how financing for the transition to zero carbon can be provided pre-independence. North Ayrshire Council is currently exploring potential for investment in the local economy by the Strathclyde Pension Fund as part of the Council's community wealth building strategy. This approach could and should be expanded and replicated elsewhere. The current UK fiscal framework gives the Scottish Government powers to borrow up to £3 billion for capital investment with an annual limit of £450 million. Local authorities have borrowing powers for capital investments. The government and local authorities should start to borrow now in order to invest in the foundations for our future economy. Provided the borrowing is in sterling and does not involve borrowing from the UK government, once we've established our own currency, these debts can be redenominated in Scottish pounds. Private investors, wherever they are based, will be repaid in Scottish pounds instead of pounds. The ScotGov and local authorities could issue a special category of bond, green bonds and green municipal bonds, for example, offered solely to LGPS pension funds and other workplace and private pension funds. If an attractive rate of interest is offered on a long-dated bond, 10 years plus, this will give pension funds greater scope to fully disinvest from fossil fuels and other sectors and companies whose activities harm the environment, without breaching the current law of fiduciary duty, which we will eventually need to replace with a new statutory framework. The LGPS pension funds are fully funded out of public money. Central government grants to local authorities and local taxation are the source of all pension contributions into them by employees and employees. While the funds owe a fiduciary duty to the members of these pension schemes, they should also owe a duty to invest in Scotland's national interest. Long-dated bonds issued before independence in sterling will carry the lowest level of risk of any class of financial asset, because the Scott Gov will always be able to repay the debt once Scotland has its own currency and central bank. The debts in sterling will be redenominated in Scottish pounds after independence, and then, once Scotland has become a currency issuer, it can never run out of money. While, like any other country on earth, we can run out of resources, labour, skills, technology, land and other physical resources, we cannot run out of money once we have our own currency. It is becoming clear that the UK government is intent on strangling the Scottish economy ahead of an independence referendum. The decision not to invest in carbon capture and storage infrastructure in Scotland tells us where the UK government's priorities are. CCS does not work, but that is not the point. The UK government believes it does. Borrowing in the way described above will provide the Scottish government with a means to compensate for this deliberate choking of investment in Scotland. ScotGov borrowing now could help us start to do things which do work, such as improving the thermal efficiency of Scottish housing and starting to build a district heating network to replace our reliance on gas for domestic heating, while also investing in ways which support local and Scottish-based businesses. It could also provide the financial means to buy out private finance initiative, PFI, contracts at a discount, not at the full lifetime value to the PFI investors, as happened in the case of the buyout of the Sky Bridge from the consortium which built it and then charged tolls to users. Doing this would end an exorbitant drain of public funds to PFI investors and reduce the cost of important public infrastructure such as hospitals, other health facilities, schools, prisons and so on. This would reduce ScotGov and local authorities' liabilities and free up finance for the new Scottish priorities. And that article is by Jim Osborne of the Scottish Banking and Finance Group. From The National, Monday the 8th of November 2021, from the comments section, Stephen Payton, Owen Paterson scandal leaves Scottish Tories stuck in a dilemma. Article by Stephen Payton. Picture of the scene. You take a friend to a party, you're worried won't quite match the vibe and, after vociferously vouching for them to your pals, they go on to dramatically embarrass you. We've all been there. Actually, that hasn't happened to me. Maybe I was the embarrassment. Excuse me for thinking this was an appropriate time to talk about real infrastructure. Regardless, no matter how mortifying it is to have this happen, it pales in comparison to what the Scottish Tories are currently going through. Having vouched hard for the UK Conservative Party as the last best hope for Scotland and the Union, they've only turned around and gotten themselves embroiled in yet another lobbying scandal. Yet it is not really Owen Paterson's behaviour that has led to the wailing and gnashing of teeth from the Scottish Tories, but rather the cardinal sin of having drawn attention to it. The Tory party goes with sleaze and corruption like a cop does a kettle. And somewhat disturbing truth is that, knowing this to be the case, their actions are often shrugged off with a, well, you know, that's what they're like. But trying to wriggle out of the accountability and reverse the rather slight consequences offered for taking part in paid advocacy is what has really knocked over the teacup and set the storm loose in public. Had Paterson just taken his 30-day suspension from Parliament, our press would have moved on and been back to bashing transgender people within the week. But not now. To be clear, the trans bashing will likely continue, but a Tory MP might also find themselves involved every now and then too, just to mix things up a little. If we want to truly judge the institution of Westminster, we can't limit ourselves to just what the governing party has managed to get away with, but what they have tried to get away with too. And what these past few days have shown is that the Conservatives are ready and willing to rip up any form of accountability to protect their class. While Boris Johnson may have U-turned in the decision to functionally scrap the parliamentary standard system in favour of a superficial, Tory-led appeals process, that doesn't change the fact that they endeavoured to do so in the first place, nor that he whipped MPs into backing those short-sighted plans to let Paterson off the hook. The Conservatives tried to blatantly game the system for their own benefit, and now the Scottish Tories have been left to make the case that it is right that Westminster continues to limit and, more and more often in recent history, overstepped the boundaries of devolution, stuck arguing that an institution repeatedly revealed to be a den of corruption and sleaze as a superior decision maker to our own elected parliament. That's where the true source of the Scottish Tories' ire lies. Because to acknowledge that there's an institutional problem within Westminster and the Conservative Party is to recognise that there is a meaningful case for Scotland to leave the UK. If the broad shoulders of the Union are shown to be led to greedy hands of parliamentarians like Owen Paterson, the argument for staying crumbles. Paterson is in no way an outlier or a bad apple within the barrel. For the past 20 years, all 16 of the Conservative Party's main treasurers, whose donations to the party have exceeded £3 million, have been set up upon a political conveyor belt that has taken them from party donor to party treasurer to peer. Barring the most recent treasurer, who stepped down a couple of months ago, every single one has been offered a seat in the House of Lords after making serious contributions to the party coffers. Closer to home, we had our own questionable peerage handed to Malcolm Offord, a former anti-Indy campaigner who was slipped into the House of Lords and given a role in the Scotland office after handing almost £150,000 to the Tories. There is even speculation that Johnson's bombastic assault on the standards process and on Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards Catherine Stone may be driven in part by fears of an investigation into his own behaviour after he reportedly accepted £200,000 from a Tory donor to refurbish his flat. Owen Paterson is a prime example of what it means to be a Tory politician, whose definition of cruelty is to be held accountable for their actions. And that is how Paterson describes his ordeal: intolerable and cruel. I'll let you, reader, pass judgment on a man who believes accountability is cruelty, while his inhumane colleague, Priti Patel, attempts to give Border Force staff immunity over migrants drowning under their watch. With the eyes of the world in the UK for COP26, Boris Johnson and his cohort take a step further than even a right-wing press were willing to defend and dramatically undermined the case for the UK Union while they were at it. How can we trust that any decision made at Westminster is based on anything more than whose money is in whose pockets when they step into the Commons? The discomfort of the Union-minded Scottish Tories seems more tired to be made to look like fools than the fact that one of their colleagues collected a small fortune in fees to advocate on behalf of big businesses, one of which was handed some serious government contracts during the pandemic. Ironically, this all makes a rather striking case for the Scottish Tories forming their own independent political party, but instead, they'll continue arguing that this is as good as it can get for Scotland. And that was a comment piece by Stephen Payton. From The National, Tuesday the 9th of November 2021, from the news section: Humza Yousaf, scheme allowing pharmacists to treat minor ailments a success? By Beth Whitelaw. A scheme which allows pharmacists to treat some minor ailments has been a major success, the Health Secretary said. The scheme reduced GP appointments and the caseload of accident emergency by more than 200,000 in the last year. Humza Yousaf hailed the fantastic role pharmacists can play by helping people get the right treatment without having to go to either their family doctor or a hospital. And he said the scheme could be particularly helpful as continuing pressure on the NHS means that the health service faces one of the most difficult winters in its history. The Scottish Government launched the NHS Pharmacy First Scotland service in July 2020, with ministers now considering expanding the scheme. Under the initiative, pharmacists who are appropriately qualified can carry out consultations, referring people on to other parts of the NHS if they believe this is necessary. The pharmacists can also treat a number of conditions, such as urinary tract infections, shingles and impetigo, without the need for a prescription or to see a doctor. Pharmacists in the network have taken more than 200,000 appointments in the last year, which would otherwise have gone to GP surgeries or hospital A&E departments, the Scottish Government said. More than 1,200 community pharmacies are involved in the initiative, with more than 2 million consultations carried out since its launch. Speaking about the scheme, Yousaf said, "Community pharmacists are playing a fantastic role in ensuring that millions of people have their minor ailments addressed quickly without needing to go to a GP or hospital. They are a prime example of getting the right care in the right place at the right time. This is particularly helpful as our NHS faces one of the most difficult winters in its history, with the NHS Pharmacy First Service helping to relieve some of the current pressures faced by emergency departments. He urged people, as community pharmacy staff continue to give care and advice during the busy winter period, please continue to be kind and patient. The Health Secretary said, the Scottish Government introduced the NHS Pharmacy First Service backed by £10 million of investment. As part of the NHS Recovery Plan, we will look to expand the range of common clinical conditions that can be treated by community pharmacists, avoiding unnecessary GP and out-of-hours appointments. We have also committed to establishing a community pharmacy hospital discharge and medicines reconciliation service to help speed up the process for people being discharged from hospital. He added, new digital solutions such as e-prescribing and e-dispensing will make prescribing paperless and free up capacity for healthcare professionals to see more patients, while making it easier for the public to access their medicines quickly and safely. And that piece was by Beth Whitelaw.
The National, recorded on Tuesday 9th of November 2021. Comment. Gerry Hassan, Brian Cox set tone for way yes debate should be conducted by Gerry Hassan. The past week has been one of the worst in British public life for decades as the scale of corruption in the UK government and among the Tories has been further revealed. This should be a good time for Labour and Keir Starmer, the latter appearing in the BBC's Andrew Marr show on Sunday after a period in isolation due to COVID. Instead, Starmer gave an interview where his main takeaway was that the UK should shift focus from get Brexit done to make Brexit work, hardly an inspiring opposition line. Then came Starmer's set of exchanges with the Hollywood actor Brian Cox, who used to be a Labour supporter and is now pro-independence. This revealed something about the state of British politics, the position of Labour, and where Scotland and independence fits into all of this, with significant potential consequences for all these and more. One critical element is the Starmer-Cox exchange was the tone and respect from both individuals. Marr asked Cox why, when he had once supported Labour and now supported independence, Cox replied, "It's a long story and it comes down to what I thought was a failure of social democracy. Also the Iraq War, that affected me. Blair's hubris affected me, and I saw the party going in a certain direction and I was really very concerned because I'm a socialist." He continued about his loss of faith in Labour. "I totally agree with Keir in so many things, but my country was traduced for long enough, time and time again. We voted 62% to stay in Europe and we were ignored. And if you think about the Thatcher years, we were ignored. Scotland has always been sidelined." Famous actors talking politics doesn't always work, and they can be challenging figures to offer any counter-view or criticism of. Starmer had to choose his words and comments carefully. Starmer, as you would expect from a Labour Party which has defined itself historically as conservative in how it does politics, views other parties and sees constitutional matters in the UK, ruled out making any overtures to the SNP and independence pre-election, saying there is no basis for a deal before we go into an election, nor coming out of an election. This is predictable but foolish. Labour has to gain a minimum of 124 seats, brackets on the old boundaries, close brackets, to win a bare majority, and this is unlikely to happen. What this means is that post-election, if the Tories lost their majority, Labour would have to win SNP parliamentary votes and critically, pre-election, as in 2015, deal with a Tory onslaught making hay of the prospect of a minority Labour government enthralled to the Nationalists. Better to prepare for that Tory assault now by acclimatising Labour and voters to dealing with the SNP, but that's sadly not the Labour way. The other takeaway is big. The tone and feeling of how independence is talked about, and particularly presented to sceptical and English audiences. Cox's tone was filled with a deep sense of sadness and regret for the passing of a former sense of a shared UK project, which Labour at its best did much to build. This was an elegy for a lost Britain, one that many older voters across the UK felt inspired by and trusted, which spoke not just of the common bounds across these isles, but about solidarity and interdependence. This past has been diminished and diluted not just by this Tory government, but by successive Westminster administrations. This tone and emotional intelligence was noted. The author Jonathan Rowson commented, "What I liked about this extract is that Brian Cox clearly has a view, but it's held with a certain amount of pain and regret at forsaking the UK. That's where I am with Scottish independence too. It's not right in some preordained way, but it just feels necessary now." The Labour supporter Mark Perryman added, "Just look at Keir Starmer's face as he listens to Brian Cox," Pat Kane observed. "Cox's point about Scotland's pro-EU vote is the killer, becoming more salient as the years pass." While Gareth Young stated, "Starmer's wishing that the audience wasn't 85% English. He wants to make a lot of nice promises and say that he'll put Scotland first, but he knows England is watching." Starmer was walking a tightrope, as leaders often have to do, but various insights emerged from Cox's remarks. Firstly, that language of regret and sadness is a powerful one on independence to a number of audiences, floating and sceptical voters, the RUK, and in particular parts of England. How Scottish independence poses its farewell to the UK / RUK has profound consequences. It should never be framed in triumphant, self-satisfied tones, which we have seen with Brexit. It should avoid the mindset of saying good riddance and putting up two fingers to the rest of the UK. A language of regret and sadness filled with an awareness of the good times and elegy for that lost Britain not coming back is both right and mature, also tapping into the deep feelings of resentment and dissatisfaction found across the rest of the UK at the state of things. Secondly, the process of independence is, to use that phrase, a process, not an event. What Scotland makes of independence has already been in part shaped by the present and the nature of any future farewell made in the here and now. Not only that, the tone and emotional intelligence of our farewell also determines the nature of Scotland's entrance and re-emergence in the international stage. The Starmer-Cox exchange offered many lessons. This is not to claim Cox is some sage who has got everything right in his political pronouncements, or not to appreciate the strategic challenges Keir Starmer and Labour face, but politics is about deep issues and factors which only sometimes are openly talked about. Not only do Labour need to think past their inherent conservatism and belief in one-party Labour government, but we need to understand the emotional undercurrents which independence brings up for many, and learn to speak with an emotional literacy, both about the positives, but also the challenges, confusion and loss that it brings up for many. By Jerry Hassan.
Recorded from The National on the 9th of November 2021. From the Culture section. Scottish Ballet commits to anti-racist productions with upcoming Nutcracker by Beth Whitelaw. An upcoming production of The Nutcracker will feature subtle but important changes in a commitment to tackling racism in ballet. Scottish Ballet said the Chinese and Arabian-inspired scenes in The Land of Sweets will have updated costumes and choreography to remove elements of caricature. Christopher Hampson, Scottish Ballet's artistic director, said, "Rectifying inappropriate cultural stereotypes will add to the heritage of the production." The magician character, Drosselmeyer, will be played by both male and female dancers in this tour, which opens at the Festival Theatre in Edinburgh on December 1st. Hampson, who is also the dance company's chief executive, said, "At Scottish Ballet, we want to drive anti-racism clear and simple. If we see racist stereotypes or if we hear about racism within the ballet world, it must be addressed." The Nutcracker was created in 1972, when it was acceptable to represent other cultures through imitation. If we are representing a culture, it's important that we have done our due diligence to ensure it is done so authentically. By rectifying inappropriate cultural stereotypes, we are adding to the production's heritage and making it richer. Art must evolve to speak to our times, which is why our Drosselmeyer will be played by male and female dancers. "I made this change after considering who our heroes are in ballets, and it struck me that there was nothing about this role that suggested only a man could deliver it." Scottish Ballet said that in an era of the Black Lives Matter movement, it has made the commitment to tackling racism within the industry by becoming a more visible, active ally to people and organisations who have demonstrated a sustained commitment to the cause. Last year, Scottish Ballet reviewed its production of The Snow Queen and said it found there was an opportunity to better represent Gypsy, Roma and Traveller, GRT, culture within the work, adjusting costumes, props and choreography as a result of that process. The Nutcracker will tour Edinburgh, Glasgow, Inverness, Aberdeen, Newcastle and Belfast between December 2021 and February 2022. That article was by Beth Whitelaw.
From The National, Wednesday the 10th of November 2021, from the news section, AOC's priorities in Glasgow include trying Iron Brew and touching Harris Tweed. Report by Laura Webster. US Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is keen to get her hands on Scotland's other national drink. The Democrat arrived at the COP26 UN Climate Summit in Glasgow on Tuesday as part of a US congressional delegation. Posting on Instagram, she said she wants to try Iron Brew while in Scotland. In response to a question of whether she has sampled the Bright Orange Fizzy drink, she wrote, "I am trying to get my hands on some. So far it's been non-stop work with no real independent time, so I'm hoping for a window to find some. The schedule has us leave early and get back late. Where do I find it? Do y'all have bodegas here?" Responding to another question, she repeated her wish to try Iron Brew and said she also wants to touch Harris Tweed and see a castle. She said the delegation schedule is jammed, but she hopes to have a few hours in the next few days for us to actually see this beautiful place. On Tuesday, the Congresswoman spoke at a press conference at the Climate Summit and also attended an event on gender and the climate crisis, at which the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, made a speech. And that piece was by Laura Webster. From The National, Wednesday the 10th of November 2021, from the politics section, MP Andrew Bowie quits as Vice Chair of Conservative Party. By Craig Meehan. Scottish MP Andrew Bowie has resigned as Vice Chair of the Conservative Party, it has been confirmed. The West Aberdeenshire and Kincardine MP is choosing to step back from his position to focus his time on his constituents, he said. However, it comes as the UK government faces several scandals in recent days, including the Cash for Honour scandal and the Owen Paterson row. An Open Democracy and Sunday Times investigation found 9 of the party's former treasurers have been elevated to the House of Lords since the Conservatives returned to power in 2010. Meanwhile, former Tory MP Paterson resigned after a government move to change the way MPs are punished backfired. Paterson was found to have broken lobbying rules at Westminster. Bowie was among the Scottish Tory MPs who voted to help Paterson avoid suspension, despite Paterson being found guilty of breaking the rules. According to the BBC, Bowie is unhappy with how the government handled the debacle. A spokesperson told the BBC that Bowie's resignation is in no way connected with the events of last week. Bowie said, "I was honoured to serve as Vice Chair of the Conservative and Unionist Party. However, over the last few months, I've come to the decision that I need to take a step back from the demands of the role to focus on representing my constituents in West Aberdeenshire and Kincardine. I formally asked the party yesterday if I could step back from my position and I will remain in post until they have found a successor." And that story was by Craig Meehan. From The National, Wednesday the 10th of November 2021, from the news section, The Guile, hunt for men after car used to break into Edinburgh shopping centre, by Laura Webster. Two men have used a stolen car to break into a shopping centre, leaving the vehicle behind when they fled empty-handed. The car, a silver Suzuki Celerio, was used to force entry into the main area of The Guile in Edinburgh at around 2:50 a.m. on Wednesday. The men tried to get into a business inside the centre, but did not succeed and left in a second vehicle, described as a silver saloon-type car. Police said the first vehicle, which was left in the shopping centre, had been stolen from the Stevenson Road area of Edinburgh on Tuesday evening. Detective Inspector George Calder said, "Our inquiries into this incident are ongoing and I would urge anyone who may be able to help to get in touch. We would be keen to speak to anyone who may be able to help us establish the movements of the two vehicles involved or identify the two men seen at the Guile Centre. We would also be keen to speak to anyone who may have a dash cam or private CCTV footage which could help our investigation. Anyone with information can call 101, quoting 0246 of November the 10th, or call Crime Stoppers on 0800 555 111. Both men involved are described as being of slim build and were wearing dark clothing with hoods up and their faces covered. And that article is by Laura Webster.
Recorded from The National on the 10th of November 2021, from the Culture section, First Minister to Push for Climate Justice for Those in Global South during COP26, by Gregor Young. The First Minister will use the final week of COP26 to push for climate justice and aid for those in the Global South. The importance of Indigenous people has been thrust to the front of the Climate Summit in Glasgow, with such communities leading climate marches through the city over the weekend. Nicola Sturgeon will today meet faith leaders from around the world to discuss the role of religion in bringing communities together to tackle climate issues. She will then take part in a presentation with representatives of Malawi and Tanzania as part of a series of talks co-hosted by the Scottish Government. The First Minister will then meet leaders from islands and regions throughout the rest of the week as the summit reaches its close. Some progress was made last week with commitments on forestry, methane, coal and pledges that, if delivered, could reduce the gap between the 1.5 degrees C target that science says we must hit and the 2.7 degrees centigrade trajectory we are currently on. But there is still a long way to go to deliver a fair and just outcome for all countries at COP26, she said, ahead of the meetings. The next 5 days are critical to countries in the South who need fair financial support now to adapt to and mitigate the impacts of the climate emergency and who need to see clear steps taken to keep the target of capping temperature increases at 1.5 degrees C alive. Sturgeon added, on the day where adaptation, loss and damage as a result of climate change are at the heart of COP, I am determined to do what I can to ensure leaders and negotiators hear the voices of those most impacted by the climate emergency. It is why we've committed to doubling our world-first climate justice fund to £24 million and announced a £1 million partnership to help some of the world's most vulnerable communities tackle structural inequalities and recover from climate-induced loss and damage. Over the next 5 days, the world will be watching to see if the sense of optimism that has built up through last week can be turned into real action by countries around the world to tackle the climate crisis. That article was by Gregor Young.
From The National, Thursday the 11th of November 2021, from the Politics section, Northeast Scotland deserves better than spineless Scottish Tories, by Kenny Anderson. The corruption and sleaze currently engulfing the UK Conservative government has claimed yet another casualty in what is likely to be a lengthy list of Conservatives, as the Tory Vice Chairman Andrew Bowie MP has resigned his position from a senior role. Is this, as he claims, a selfless step back for the onerous additional duties of paid office? Or is it some self-preservation reflex to protect his precarious ambitions? The pathetically loyal MP for West Aberdeenshire and Kincardine defends a highly marginal Scottish constituency, having a majority of just 843 at the 2019 general election, as he saw his vote share slump by 5.2%, while his SNP rival, Fergus Much, saw his vote share increase by 8.6%, the highest number of votes cast for an SNP candidate in this seat ever. Indeed, without a massive slump in the Lib Dem vote, it wouldn't have been Mr Bowie MP but Mr Much MP. Bear in mind that until 2015 was a Lib Dem seat. Bowie has done all he can to curry favour in the high echelons of conservatism, but to no effect. He must loathe his phone when a ministerial vacancy arises or a junior minister reshuffle commences, as time after time he's ignored. How often, I wonder, does he forlornly check his mobile phone and its signal strength, the Wi-Fi signal, or the ringer volume on his phone? Staying awake until the cold dawn comes with it the chilling realisation that his craven behaviours have counted for naught, and he has been passed over yet again, probably by some unelected Tory donor. Turning to his performance as a constituency MP, Wi-Fi and phone signal we will come back to haunt him. West Aberdeenshire encompasses coastal communities like Stonehaven, the commuter suburbs like West Hill, as well as Royal Deeside, and includes some of the highest mountains in the UK. In large part, the constituency suffers woeful Wi-Fi and mobile phone speeds and coverage. Has Bowie scaled the heights with his advocacy on behalf of a largely rural community? The answer is no. On Reserve Westminster issues like Wi-Fi and phone coverage, he's been largely invisible. The Electric of Aberdeenshire West comprises hard-working people, including traditional, small-scale fishing and farming communities. Farm tenancies are the norm within large estates. Many within the commuting towns have, in the past, enjoyed excellent prospects within the oil and gas industry, but these are in decline, and given the recent betrayal by the Tories with the Acorn carbon capture scheme, another broken promise materialises. Their weasel words on a just transition echo hollowly around abandoned communities. In addition, tenant farming is a tough, harsh world, as is the inshore fishing that is typical of the coastal communities in Bowie's constituency. All have been bitterly betrayed by false Brexit promises. Last week, Andrew Bowie voted to let his mate, the disgraced former MP Owen Paterson, off the hook in accordance with the direction of the Tory government whips. Within 24 hours, the Tory hierarchy U-turned, leaving the spineless Bowie and fellow Scottish Tories isolated under severe attack and scrutiny. The human body collapses without a spine, and it seems likely the Tory vote in West Aberdeenshire and Kirkcaldy will also collapse. This will be mirrored in other constituencies represented by Tories, where there is an electorate with a hard-working, no-nonsense ethos. And that was an article by Kenny Anderson. From The National, Thursday the 11th of November 2021, from the news section, Scottish Ambulance Service in Emergency Drive to Accelerate Recruitment, by Jane McLeod. The Scottish Ambulance Service has said it will be accelerating recruitment of staff to boost capacity amid current pressures on the system. A total of 356 frontline paramedics, technicians and ambulance care assistants will join the service by March. The ambulance service has been under pressure in recent months, and long waits for ambulances prompted the Scottish Government to call in the help of both the Army and firefighters to drive some non-emergency vehicles. Between October and November, 179 new staff will have joined the Scottish Ambulance Service, and a further 177 will be recruited by March 2022. Scottish Ambulance Service Chief Executive Pauline Howie said, "We know that this is one of the most significant periods of pressure on the NHS since its inception. All parts of the system are under pressure, and it's been tough out there for our staff and patients. Everyone is working so hard to help patients and our staff continue to do a fantastic job. We know that there will be a little let up in those pressures over the next few months, so we're accelerating our efforts to increase capacity and do everything we can to support staff. These new staff coming in will be a real boost. We continue to prioritise those patients who are most critically ill, and staff continue to go above and beyond to save lives, with survival figures for patients in our most acute response category at their highest ever level. It is a real testament to their ability to deliver, despite the wider pressures upon the system. For those lower acuity patients who do have to wait longer for an ambulance, we are trying to get to you as quickly as we can. The new intake follows the recruitment and training of 210 staff over the last 6 months. The Scottish Ambulance Service said new figures showed there has been a rise in 30-day survival for patients within its most seriously ill response category, with latest data showing the number of people surviving is at its highest ever level. It said that from January to May 2021, the 30-day survival data steadily rose month on month to a high of 50.4% of people in this category. Howie said the service is taking a range of actions to reduce waits, including working closely with NHS boards to address turnaround times and boosting staffing numbers through accelerated recruitment. She added, "As we move into the winter period, we would ask the public to continue to use 999 wisely. If people have serious health concerns or symptoms, call 999. If your condition isn't life-threatening, you should call NHS 24 and 111. Meanwhile, female detainees were forced to mix with men with a history of sexual violence against women in an immigration centre due to COVID restrictions, a report has found. concerns have been raised about Dungavel Immigration Removal Centre in Lanarkshire after inspectors found women had to be escorted around the site to make sure they were safe from some of the male detainees. The report said, before the pandemic, these men were held in a separate unit with controlled access to common parts of the centre. But due to COVID infection control arrangements, this was no longer considered possible and women had to be accompanied on site. The report said the centre's safer detention policy had improved with regards to care of women compared to the last inspection in 2018. But the most recent report showed the matter was not discussed substantively, other than stating that the centre was holding men who presented a risk to women and that the monthly safer detention meeting was poorly attended. And that article is by Jane McLeod. From The National, Thursday the 11th of November 2021, from the politics section, Tories accused of disgusting smear of SNP MPs on trip to Gibraltar. Article by Richard Mason. The Conservatives have been accused of creating a disgusting political smear of two SNP MPs and one Labour MP ahead of Armistice Day. Drew Hendry and David Linden are taking part in an Armed Forces parliamentary visit to Gibraltar for Armistice Day as part of a group of MPs. However, several newspapers were briefed last night on the two SNP members reportedly being drunk and disorderly while on the British Airways flight to Gibraltar. One Labour MP was also said to be drunk while on the flight from Heathrow. There have also been unconfirmed reports that two Tory MPs had been drinking until 2 a.m. UK Defence Secretary Ben Wallace has said he is planning to complain to Ian Blackford and Keir Starmer about the apparent actions of the MPs, saying they showed a lack of respect for the work of the armed forces at risk undermining respect for Parliament. An unnamed source is quoted in the Telegraph as saying that the MPs were quite clearly drunk in the airport before the flight and then drank heavily on the plane. They are also alleged to have been rude to staff when COVID passports did not work. The SNP MPs have denied the allegations made about them and say it is an attempt to divert attention from Tory corruption scandals currently engulfing the UK government. An SNP source told the Herald, "The fact that this was briefed to three Tory supporting newspapers, with only Tories actually claiming it happened, says it all." Drew and David were not drunk. They arrived at 4:45. And they were at the reception at 6:30. They were in bed by 10:30 p.m. or so that evening, and, in fact, two Tory MPs stayed out in the lash till 2 a.m. They've not missed any events, and have not even talked to those who have suddenly made these claims. It is a disgusting political smear on the eve of Armistice Day. The Tories cannot sink any lower. The SNP MPs shared pictures of themselves on the trip with the parliamentary group last night, but responded to the allegations themselves. Hendry, the MP for Inverness, Nairn, Badenoch and Strathbay, said that it was deeply disappointing that the claims had been made and that it was a shameless attempt to divert attention from Tory sleaze. He added, "This is a matter for their conscience. I'll focus on doing my job and respecting your troops as we mark Armistice Day." Linden, the MP for Glasgow East, said, "Incredibly disappointed by what appears to be a bizarre Tory smear campaign in the media tonight, but I'll leave the politics to others. Instead, I'll continue to focus on participating in briefings with service personnel, meetings with local officials, as well as continuing to undertake training exercises and hear firsthand from those who serve in the armed services here in Gibraltar." Wallace is reported to have said, "This type of behaviour shows a lack of respect for the enduring work of our armed forces." The armed forces scheme is an opportunity for both parliamentarians and the military to understand each other. This behaviour puts military personnel in a difficult position and risks undermining respect for Parliament. Scottish Finance Secretary Kate Forbes was also shocked to hear of the allegations, tweeting, "As somebody who has worked closely with David Linden and Drew Hendry SNP over many years, I can say unequivocally that last night's malicious smear is utterly at odds with the professional, respectful MPs many of us have known for years." It comes after Tory MP Geoffrey Cox, has faced criticism and a referral to Westminster's Standards Commissioner after he was found to have used his parliamentary office for work for another job. The MP in QC earned more than £1 million on top of his MP salary last year for legal work, including advising the government of the British Virgin Islands in a Foreign Office investigation of corruption in the tax haven. Boris Johnson last night refused to apologise for the sleaze row engulfing his government at COP26 press conference, where he came under sustained questions about the Owen Paterson scandal. Paterson announced that he would be stepping down as an MP after he was found to have breached lobbying rules. The Tories attempted to stop his 6-week suspension but then U-turned. Johnson did not apologise, saying MPs found to have broken conduct rules should be punished. And that was an article by Richard Mason.
The National, recorded on Thursday, 11th of November 2021. Comment: David Pratt, Tory sleaze has paid off for them. It must pay off for independence. By David Pratt, Foreign Affairs Editor. Sleaze, it's the Tory gift that keeps on giving. At least that, I'm sure, is the way many members of Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government view this nefarious but lucrative practice, just as many within their ranks at Westminster did so before them. When it comes to the Tories, sleaze, is, it would seem, is part of the political DNA. Yes, I know they're not the only culprits with a predisposition for having their snouts in the trough, but as history has shown, they have made it something of a specialism in political raison d'etre. Who, after all, can forget that sleaze-filled decade of the 1990s, a time when low life and high office saw Tory MP Neil Hamilton accused of taking bungs of cash in brown envelopes for alleged activities in Parliament on behalf of Mohammed Al-Fayed, then owner of Harrods? Not to be outdone, it was then the turn of one-time Tory Minister for Defence Procurement, Jonathan Aitken, to allow aides of the Saudi royal family to pay his hotel bill during a stay at the Paris Ritz in September 1993. The Old Bailey gave Aitken 18 months in the pokey for perjury and perverting the course of justice after the gallant Aitken had tried to get his wife and young daughter to provide an alibi for him. But hey, this is all pipsqueak stuff compared to the cunt crew like Owen Paterson and now former Attorney General Geoffrey Cox, who would appear to see their parliamentary duties as secondary to hauling in as much wonga from wherever they can. Make no mistake about it, there is a pattern here, and sleaze does not just begin and end with second jobs and lobbying. There are still, for example, those unanswered questions over allegations that Tory MPs helped associates gain lucrative COVID contracts. Then there is that little matter of Boris Johnson's flat refurbishment, questions over how peerages are handed out, attempts to sway watchdog panels and the terms under which parliamentary passes are granted. In the case of the latter, even Aitken was awarded a grace in favour parliamentary pass despite the House of Commons claiming the ex-MPs jailed for more than a year were ineligible. That term, grace in favour, only serves to underline once again what most of us would have suspected about there being one rule for some and another for the rest of us ordinary constituents and taxpayers, with whose dime these reptiles play fast and loose. Which brings me to my real point here, which is that if Tory sleaze is the gift that keeps on giving, then this is surely is the moment, if ever there was one, for us giving it back with double-barrelled political force to sink them at the ballot box, and in Scotland's case use it as a tool for bringing about independence. Only the most short-sighted would fail to see this as the perfect tactical moment and political opportunity that must be exploited to the hilt by the Scottish Government, SNP MPs at Westminster and all Scots engaged in campaigning for our sovereignty. This, put quite simply, is the Tories' Achilles heel, the political spot where they're most vulnerable, and as such it needs to be attacked again and again, alongside which we must make the case with renewed and uncompromising vigour that Scotland does not wish to be and will not be ruled by those filling their pockets at our expense. Those who doubt how imperative this moment is need only listen to how rattled some within the Tory ranks are right now. Only last week, the I newspaper quoted one serving Tory minister warning of a real danger that the accusation of sleaze will keep being prodded and that there are worries that this will begin to harm us. By all accounts, he's not alone, and you can see why after a YouGov poll last Thursday showed the Tories' lead had been cut from 5 percentage points just to 1 in the wake of the Paterson scandal. Since then, things have only become worse, for financial scandals are toxic and shown themselves to have a persistent, profound and lasting impact on UK politics. Through their own arrogance, the Tories have handed those that oppose them the perfect weapon with which to retaliate. The real question now centres on whether the political weapon will be utilised to full advantage, and the pressure sustained and unrelenting in a way that will damage the Tories and gain real opposition leverage along the way. In other words, this then is not simply the moment just to keep prodding, but instead fully harness their weakness to the extent that it should become a campaigning platform that the Scottish independence movement should embrace wholesale. To date, the record of SNP members at Westminster holding Johnson's government to account has been mixed, to say the least. Lately too, I'm sure I'm not alone in recognising that the independence campaign has been going through what at best could be described as something of a hiatus, and at worst a damaging period of rather bitter infighting. But as witnessed at COP26, Scotland can, when needed, play a canny game in presenting our nation's hopes and aspirations to a world audience. That job done, it is time once again for the Scottish Government and elected officials at Westminster, as well as those indie activists who make things tick at the grassroots level, to look at our domestic audience and remind them we have their best interests at heart, and Tory sleaze will not be allowed to undermine that. Such is the repugnance so many people feel at those that profit at the expense of others and renege on their elected duties that it often crosses the political divide. If ever an issue had the potential to help all of us renew our indie solidarity against the threats and challenges posed by Johnson's cabal and make the case for independence crystal clear, even to doubters, then the sleaze that lies at the rotten heart of the UK government is that issue. It's time to roll up our sleeves and get the gloves off. By David Pratt, The National, recorded on Thursday, 11th of November 2021. Comment: Holyrood cannot hide behind devolution when it comes to climate change. By Andrew Watterson. The failures of the Scottish oil and gas industries, their professional advisers, advocates, lobbyists and apologists to cut carbon and protect global and Scottish public health can surely not be justified in any form. Will the Scottish Government now finally act urgently to curtail or reduce the industry's development onshore and offshore, where it has powers over public procurement, planning, enterprise funding and public health to do so? Politicians need to escape from their short-term, self-interested thinking and address the climate crisis as the principal national political priority. They must move away from warm words for and photo opportunities with climate campaigners that mean nothing and take major and far-reaching action in the Scottish oil and gas industry. Procrastination and obfuscation are no longer options. The reasons why are outlined below. The International Energy Association report months ago on net zero approaches made it clear oil and gas companies must stop all new oil and gas developments from 2021 if global warming was to be halted. This was not an option but a necessity, and could be done by cutting energy demands and carbon emissions linked to the ways we run our societies and economies. This must mean the Cambo field should not be developed, nor should other smaller but similar projects floated in recent weeks. The Scottish Government should unequivocally oppose these developments, even though it may not currently have the powers to stop them. Bill Hare, the Chief Executive of Climate Analytics, in November has also been crystal clear. Natural gas is not a bridging fuel, it is a fossil fuel, gas is the new coal. Governments, investors and the financial sector must treat it the same way as they do coal, phase it out as soon as possible. Massachusetts and other US states are presently taking companies like ExxonMobil to court over their global climate effects and greenwashing that misleads the public. Little similar action seems to be happening in the UK or Scotland. ExxonMobil has, according to the BBC in November 6, 2021, invested more than $10 billion, brackets, £7.25 billion, close brackets, over the past 20 years in researching and developing what it describes as lower emission energy solutions. But the company's latest annual report shows it invested $10.4 billion just in 2020 to develop new unexplored oil and gas reserves. In Scotland, ExxonMobil's Mossmorran ethylene cracker plant, started in the 1980s, supplies chemicals for plastics and shells. Plant produces propane, butane, natural gasoline, and provide ethane for ExxonMobil. Both companies have large carbon footprints and so are significant contributors to climate change. Independent US reports reveal plastics is the new coal in that country because the US plastics industry's contribution to climate change is on track to exceed that of US coal-fired power by 2030 and is reliant on fracked gas. Scottish oil and gas companies also have developments in countries like Nigeria, where the industry directly and indirectly has had major local and global environmental and public health impacts through climate change and air pollution. Cutting the demand for plastics made from oil and gas will be important, as will recycling. However, the key approach must be upstream governmental interventions that sunset fossil fuels as soon as possible, linked to just transition, fair work, green jobs and toxics use reduction. The Scottish Government has moved forward slowly in some, but by no means all, of these remedies. The big oil and gas and plastics industries have had years to change their approach. Green chemistry researchers, for example, identified bio-based alternatives to oil and gas-based ethylene for plastics. Yet it seems both ExxonMobil and Shell at Mossmorran effectively ignored green chemistry solutions over the decades, although Exxon was involved, ironically, in early discussions in the 1980s to establish toxics use reduction policies in Massachusetts. Neither company are listed as members of the Scottish Government initiative, Industrial Biotechnology and Innovation Centre, started in 2014, that looks for plant-based alternatives to fossil fuels. There is one other missing dimension in the various steps needed now to stop the fossil fuels industries. We can hold our politicians to account in elections, but there are those that still slip under the responsibility radar for the global climate crisis. These are the environmental consultants, lobbyists, lawyers, bankers, engineers and insurers who enable the oil and gas industries. They do not seem to have paid much attention to either environmental justice or global public health, whatever protestations to the contrary some members of these professed groups may try to make. They should now. Professor Andrew Watterson is an expert in public health and environmental justice at the University of Stirling. By Andrew Watterson, The National, recorded on Thursday, 11th of November 2021. Comment: Leslie Riddoch, Boris Johnson wants to end the union. It's the only explanation. By Leslie Riddoch, columnist. You know, maybe we've been wrong all along. Maybe Boris Johnson is not the greatest enemy of independence, but actually its greatest supporter. After all, look at the weeks past. Manfully body-swerving each opportunity to show Westminster in a good light, Boris has beaten off all contenders, brackets, and lordy, there's been a veritable win, close brackets, to prove that he alone is the gift to independence that will never stop giving. The week began with Boris in barefaced and brazen rule-bending mode. Determined to save a parliamentary pal so lacklustre few had heard of Owen Paterson, till he was exposed as a paid lobbyist. But Paterson's petulant resignation prompted Scotland's most secret double agent with an incredible opportunity. If he could conflate his chum's dilemma with some trumped-up concerns about the standards process, maybe he could annoy enough Tory MPs to provoke a reputation-shredding, righteous Scots-scunnering Commons revolt. And verily, so it came to pass. Tory MPs, brackets, who now truly understand Cummings' nickname for the PM, close brackets, were furious at being forced to back the trolley's reckless rulebook rewriting efforts against their own better judgment. Poor lambs. Apart from everything else, the disgraceful episode forced voters with memories to realise that the absence of successful revolts over benefit sanctions, universal credit uplift axing and cuts to foreign aid must mean every last one of them agreed. Yuck. Then Johnson surely contrived that contemptuous Commons debate about the Paterson affair and his own standards reform botch-up to achieve maximum aggravation in the eyes of fair-minded Scots. With the PM's now classic flair for the spineless, he ensured that the guilty parties, brackets, himself and Rees-Mogg, close brackets, were either physically absent, strolling maskless around a convenient hospital, or physically present but mentally absent, lolling maskless beside the dispatch box. Either way, a minister who had nothing to do with the decision took the heat, reminding Scots who still perversely believe in the union that real Tories never own up, never take it in the chin, never learn and never apologise. And finally, for folks perhaps distracted by the cost of living crisis or unfolding evidence of climate catastrophe, Boris unveiled his masterstroke. Geoffrey, brackets, booming posh voice so you must be right, close brackets, Cox MP, spent more time last year earning £1 million under the Caribbean sun as a QC acting for the British Virgin Isles than he did representing his own constituents. One might have expected a PM, brackets, who after all sacked Jeffers, close brackets, to issue a fierce if hypocritical condemnation. But no,
the Yes campaign's secret weapon issued only a mild reprimand. Clever. And finally, just as it seemed the story might die down, ITV's News at 10 revealed that Boris Johnson was back in London after that hospital visit in time for the Commons debate and could have done the decent thing and apologised to fellow MPs in person. But that could have gone badly wrong. Some almost terminally disillusioned No voters might have felt a glimmer of hope, believing Boris had somehow learned his lesson, taken responsibility and discovered a moral compass. So, it was tough and tempting, but Boris bravely bolted, did the wrong thing, bypassed the Commons and headed straight home for a kebab. How could anyone vote for this man, his party or his sacred cause of the Union, unless that's precisely the point? Fiendishly clever. Obviously, the biggest danger for Johnson's secret mission would be unintended victory at the COP26 summit. Mind you, the prospects of agreement never looked good. Not just because Russia and China stayed away, but because persuading them to come and resolving stumbling blocks between the 195 countries who have appeared would need a Prime Minister working full-time, flat-out, with commitment, sincerity and near-obsessive dedication. Once again, Boris spotted the dangers. Instead of copying the French, whose Paris summit triumph followed a year of hard work involving a former French Premier and 200 diplomatic staff, Boris wasted the extra Covid year he had to plan, waxed hot and cold on key issues, and left his flurry of persuasive jet trips far too late. So now Boris is in Glasgow to soften us up for no overarching COP26 deal that keeps a 1.5°C limit on global warming alive. Instead, minions are fluffing up the long grass for an interim ministerial summit in 2022, or maybe 2023, so it doesn't interrupt, stroke derail, stroke embarrass his early general election campaign. Meanwhile, Boris has clearly advised his ministers that when it comes to the climate crisis, the old excuses are always the most irritating. New Aviation Minister Robert Coates explained yesterday that draconian, brackets i.e. effective, close brackets, measures to reverse climate change might create a public pushback if implemented too soon. Wowzer, remember that utterly flawed argument from the early days of the Covid crisis, when Boris let a crucial month pass before lockdown because the bolshy old public wouldn't tolerate restriction? Well, it's back. We're all about to be blamed again for the failure to achieve international consensus at COP26 by a government that couldn't charm or negotiate its way out of a recycled paper bag. Meanwhile, on the domestic front, Johnson isn't missing a union-bashing trick, encouraging his thuggish new health secretary to issue an ultimatum to staff in the English care sector and NHS, get double jabbed or lose your jobs. How inflammatory is that in the midst of a health staffing crisis, and how puzzling when persuasion has worked in Scotland and Wales with around 95% compliance? Clearly, English workers so mistrust their own Westminster government that they're ready to sacrifice jobs they need and love rather than take the vaccinations. Who knows why that might be, but maybe the exertion of brute force and authority over underlings isn't the most effective way to govern. Sadly, it's how Tories were educated, it's what they believe, and it's how they made Westminster work for generations. They're not going to change now. So what other explanation is there? Johnson, Patel, Rees-Mogg, Javid and Gove must surely be independentistas in disguise. And look, knowing his reappearance in a reinvigorated Glasgow would only produce pelters after a week of sleaze, evasion and imminent COP failure, Boris has boldly returned, prompting Andrew Bowie MP to quit as vice chair of the Tory party, putting Douglas, brackets three jobs, close brackets, Ross in a bad light, brackets again, close brackets, and provoking more demands to withdraw the peerage bought but recently by failed Scottish Tory candidate Malcolm Offord. It takes courage to knowingly create such political havoc or adherence to an even more important secret cause. Aye, despite knowing the boos at Central Station would far exceed the booing at Bute House, and without a backdoor exit in sight, Boris bravely headed back to Yes City. Why on earth would the PM put himself through that, unless Boris is determined to boost the case for independence, brackets, and miss another outing at PMQs, close brackets? And still, it's only Thursday. Who knows what other indie-enhancing, union-destroying manoeuvre the last Prime Minister of the United Kingdom is planning to unleash before he heads home. I'll tell you one thing. Thank God he's on our side. By Leslie Riddoch.
And that was this week's The National Podcast, normally recorded in our studio at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre, currently recorded from our volunteers' homes with the publisher's kind permission. Thanks for listening.